My guest Brian Walker co-edited the new book Masters of American Comics, a companion to an exhibition presented at the Hammer Museum and the Museum of Contemporary Art in Los Angeles. Walker has not only written and edited more than a dozen books about comic history, he has a family history in comics. His father, Mort Walker, created the strips Beetle Bailey and High and Lois. Brian now works on High and Lois with his brother and is part of the team that produces Beetle Bailey. He also co-founded the International Museum of Cartoon Art. In the new book, Masters of American Comics, Brian Walker has an essay about Lionel Feininger, who created the strips The Kinder Kids and Wee Willie Winkie's World, which were first published in the Chicago Tribune in 1906. In your essay about Lionel Feininger, you quote a speech that was given in June of 1906 to a group of newspaper executives. And the name of the speech was, "Is the comic supplement a desirable feature?" And the speaker said, "The crude coloring, slapdash drawing, and very cheap and obvious funniness of the comic supplement cannot fail to debase the taste of readers and render them to a certain extent incapable of appreciating the finer forms of art." Was this a common belief at the turn of the century that comics were not only crude, but they were going to be a bad influence on the sensibilities of the readers?
Yes, I think that comics have always been seen as sort of a cheap, vulgar entertainment. In the beginning, when they first started publishing comics in Sunday newspapers in the 1890s, they were attacked by the clergy, saying this is the Lord's Day, and there shouldn't be newspapers at all published on Sunday. And then, by the next decade, the attacks were more specifically directed to the comics supplement. And there were, at the time, between about 1906 and about 1913, there was actually quite a movement of educators and people that were concerned about the morals of children, who objected to kids pulling pranks on elders, you know, which was actually common in the, you know, strips like Buster Brown. They were always dumping water on people or creating havoc in the household. And but it never really stuck. I think that the comics appealed to people and they were popular and they just kept growing, and that the protest movement died down. There were actually some newspapers that canceled their comic supplements, that actually stopped publishing comics.
Were they pressured to stop?
I think that they there were groups formed of parents and educators, religious people. I think you see this throughout the whole history of comics. Certainly the Frederick Wortham Seduction of the Innocent chapter in the 1950s, which was directed specifically against comic books at the time, that was argued that they led directly to juvenile delinquency. And we see the same now with video games, and it just goes on and on. But it's something that sort of crops up periodically in the history of comics.
Let's talk a little bit about your place in cartooning. You were actually born into cartooning. About a couple of years before you were born, your father started Beetle Bailey. What was the original premise of Beetle Bailey? And this was in what, like 1950?
Yeah, Beetle Bailey started in September 1950. Beetle Bailey originally was a college student. My father had done a series of magazine cartoons for the Saturday Evening Post starring a college student named Spider. It was based on his own experiences at the University of Missouri in his fraternity. And the strip really didn't take off the way they hoped. It was only in about 50 newspapers after the first year of syndication. And at that time, the Korean War was heating up, and he decided to have Beetle enlist. He thought maybe that could save the strip, and it did. The strip picked up some newspapers, and characters like Sarge and General Halftrack entered the cast, and the strip started to pick up in popularity. At the end of the Korean War, ironically, they were trying to sort of get back to the spit and polish days of peacetime, and the Army felt like Beetle Bailey was disrespectful to the officers, And it was canceled in the Stars and Stripes newspaper in the Pacific. And, of course, the syndicate ran with it and said the Army doesn't have a sense of humor. It turned into a national news story. And in the process, Beetle Bailey picked up about 100 new subscribers, and it was on its way to success.
You know, a lot of kids of your generation, they had their parents take away their comic books. They thought cartoons and comics were a bad influence. Your father was a comic book artist. So did you grow up surrounded by comics?
Absolutely. I think I was the only kid my age whose father had a subscription to Mad Magazine. And I used to steal them out of my father's studio and put them under my bed, and he'd say, "Who stole my Mad magazines?" But and a lot of his friends were cartoonists, so you know they became sort of an extended family. John Cullen Murphy, who did Prince Valiant for many years, was my godfather, and Dick Brown, who drew Hein Lois from the beginning and created another strip, Hagar the Horrible, actually performed my wedding ceremony. And so these were sort of like my uncles, and it was just a big extended family.
How did you end up taking over High and Lois and also working on your father's Beetle Bailey? He's still working on it as well.
Yes, my father still draws Beetle Bailey. He's been doing it for 55 years now. I think he's the longest tenured artist on his original creation. I think that he wanted to get some, particularly with High and Lois, back in the 1980s, I was just getting married and starting my own family, and he felt that High and Lois needed some new fresh blood, some writers that actually had little kids at home and were changing diapers, and so he asked me to start writing for High and Lois. And also with Beetle Bailey, he was getting some flack for the Miss Buxley character, who was people were accusing him of sexism. And
to describe the character and how she was drawn.
Well, Miss Buxley is blonde and beautiful, and she's General Halftrack's secretary. She entered the strip in 1971, and I think that he felt that Beetle Bailey needed more female characters, and he thought it was kind of a the joke is really on the general. He's this old coot, you know, who's kind of over the hill a little bit, and he's got this beautiful secretary, and he, you know, gets all excited when she walks through the room. And I think it was funny in the beginning. I think as things progressed, and some of the women readers and editors objected to it, felt that she was the butt of the jokes, she's made to look stupid, and so we tried to modify it.
Was that your job to like update her for?
Well, it was my assignment. It was one of the things I did in the beginning. And one of the things I discovered was that Miss Buxley very rarely said anything. You know, she really truly was a sex object, you know. And so more and more I had her kind of get the last laugh on the general by coming, you know, by delivering the punchline and sort of putting him down a little bit more. And it gave her a little more personality, I think, and as time has developed.
So what are some of the other generational differences that you had to deal with when you started working on Beetle Bailey and High and Lois?
Well, I think that, you know, even now, my father and I have sort of different political sensibilities. You know, we've argued about politics going back to the 60s and the Vietnam War and the rest of it. And, you know, even though politics don't enter into Beetle too often. You know, there is a certain kind of an anti-establishment feel to it. And so I try to sneak stuff like that into it. And he says, you know, this isn't Doonesbury. You know, you're not Gary Trudeau. But so, you know, we lock horns occasionally on stuff like that. You know, it is frustrating for all cartoonists and my father foremost among them that how conservative the Funnies pages are. You know, there's just things that are done on television and done in the movies and done in all forms of media and advertising. You just can't do it on the comics page. And I think particularly older established strips, the people expect them to be sort of squeaky clean. And it's frustrating for us because we're trying to compete with the other media. And there's just so much that we can't do.
What's an example of something you'd like to do, but you know you can't get away with it on the comics page?
Yeah. Well, even in High and Lois, I did, I thought, a very sort of innocuous gag. There's a strip called Rose's Rose, and I admired the sort of almost physical attraction between the husband and wife in that strip. And I said, you know, High and Lois are married. They've had children. Obviously, she's attractive. You know, he's attracted to her. God forbid that you ever show them sleeping together or anything, you know. And so I did one. It was around the time of the one of the Olympics. And she's running around this, you know, doing her usual marathon, you know, running the kids to school and grocery shopping and going to work and trying to keep all the ends together. In the very end, she's just walking and exhausted, you know, at the end of the day with her nightgown on, ready to go to bed, and High's in bed going, "Want to go for the gold?" And my editor at King Features said, "You can't do this." You know, and I said, "Why not? They're married, you know, they sleep together." And so I basically had to edit that, change the punchline, and you know, it was frustrating. Even something as tame as that is not acceptable. And oftentimes the excuse is, well, if it's a Sunday page, it's in the Sunday newspaper, kids read that and they're going to ask their mother, "What does that mean?" You know, and then the parents are going to be forced to explain that, and it creates an awkward situation. We certainly don't want editors getting mad at us and canceling the strip, and readers writing letters, and that is usually what happens when you do something that's a little off color or sort of pushing the envelope. We have readers that have been reading our strips for decades, and they're sort of been accustomed to a certain type of humor, and it might upset them if we do something that's too edgy.
So do you feel like the sensibility that's really being protected here is the sensibility of your older readers as opposed to the sensibility of younger readers? I'm just thinking younger readers, if they're actually reading anything in the newspaper, are exposed to video games and all kinds of cartoons on TV and all kinds of shows on TV. I mean, I think anything that would happen in High and Lois would be exceptionally tame compared to what most young viewers see.
And I think we frequently get letters that start off like, "I've been reading High and Lois for years, but the strip on last Sunday really offended me, and I'm not going to read it anymore." Or, you know, that's typically the kind of thing we get. And I do think that newspaper editors don't want to admit it, but that their audience is getting older, and there is an aging newspaper readership that has been reading the paper, you know, their whole lives, and has been following these comic strips, and consequently, those are the ones that have the most popularity. But we also it's curious because we occasionally get letters from people that object to all kinds of things that we do. Like, for instance, if the kids are not strapped properly in their seat belts or aren't put on properly. We got a letter a number of years ago. Lois was giving Trixie a bath, and in one panel, she got up to get a towel. And so Trixie's in the bathtub for one panel by herself, and a reader in Florida wrote in and said, "Leaving a young infant like that unattended in a bathtub is dangerous." And the editor ran it on the editorial page. It said, "Reader objects to, you know, abandoned child in bathtub," you know. And I had to call and apologize. I did an interview. And, you know, I argued, well, most people keep the towels right in the bathroom. She just got up and pulled it out of the linen closet. You know, she didn't walk away and leave Trixie unattended. But, you know, I said, this is just ridiculous that someone would go to the trouble to write a letter and get all worked up over this. But then I stopped and I thought, you know, this is actually a compliment. She thinks of Trixie as real. You know, this is just a character that's drawn in pen and ink on a piece of paper. But to this particular reader, this baby's life was in jeopardy. So we have to constantly kind of keep reminding ourselves that these characters are very real. People read it every day. They take it very seriously. And, you know, that's actually a testament, a compliment to the work that we do.
When you were growing up, were there any incidents in your life that you recognized in your father's strip?
Oh, absolutely. The strip kind of reads almost as a diary of our family life.
This is High and Lois you're talking about?
Yes. In the early 1980s, I actually did a book collection of sort of a retrospective of the best of High and Lois, and I went back and I read the strip from the beginning and read through all of it. And it was just amazing that, you know, family vacations, and I came across one specific episode where Chip was fighting with High about wearing blue jeans to school. And I remember back in the late 60s, there was what was called a dress code at you know, my junior high school in Connecticut. And, you know, boys weren't allowed to wear blue jeans, and girls weren't allowed to wear pants. And you know, it was a very strict dress code. And, of course, that was immediately what we wanted to do. We put the blue jeans on and wear them to school and then get sent home to change our pants. And I remember one time, actually, my father made sure that I had a nice pair of khakis on my way out, and I had hid the blue jeans in the bushes out in the front lawn, changed into my blue jeans, went to school, and immediately got sent home. And my father said, "How did you end up with blue jeans on?" Well, I actually found this, you know, as a gag in High and Lois. That was right about at that time. And it kind of revealed to me that at the same time my father was disciplining me and scolding me for misbehaving, he was gathering gag material for his comic strip.
And that made you feel how?
A light went on in my head, and now I do the same thing with my family. You know, my kids will do things, and you know, it seems painful, or you know, you're struggling through these issues with your family, but I can always use them for gag material later on.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay, well, it's nice talking with you.
Brian Walker is an editor of the new book, Masters of American Comics. It's a companion to exhibitions that run until March 12th at the Hammer Museum and the Museum of Contemporary Art in Los Angeles. Walker co-founded the International Museum of Cartoon Art, which is now called the National Cartoon Museum, and will reopen late this year in the Empire State Building.